exchange specialists. In the process, he made an unexpected discovery. It actually cost less per part to make small batches of stampings than to run off enormous lots. There were two reasons for this phenomenon. Making small batches eliminated the carrying cost of the huge inventories of finished parts that mass production systems required. Even more important, making only a few parts before assembling them into a car caused stamping mistakes to show up almost instantly. The consequences of this latter discovery were enormous. It made those in the stamping shop much more concerned about quality, and it eliminated the waste of large numbers of defective parts, which had to be repaired at great expense or even discarded, that were discovered only long after manufacture. But to make this system work at all, a system that ideally produced 2 hours or less of inventory, Ono needed both an extremely skilled and a highly motivated workforce. If workers failed to anticipate problems before they occurred and didn't take the initiative to devise solutions, the work of the whole factory could easily come to a halt. Holding back knowledge and effort, repeatedly noted by industrial sociologists as a salient feature of all mass production systems, would swiftly lead to disaster in Ono's factory. Lean production, company as community. As it happened, Ono's workforce acted to solve this problem for him in the late 1940s. Because of macroeconomic problems in Japan, the occupying Americans had decided to stamp out inflation through credit restrictions, but overdid it and caused a depression instead. Toyota found its nascent car business in a deep slump and was rapidly exhausting loans from its bankers. The founding family, led by President Kiichiro Toyota, proposed, as a solution to the crisis, firing a quarter of the workforce. However, the company quickly found itself in the midst of a revolt that ultimately led to its workers occupying the factory. Moreover, the company's union was in a strong position to win the strike. In 1946, when the Japanese government, under American prompting, strengthened the rights of unions, including management, and then imposed severe restrictions on the ability of company owners to fire workers, the balance of power had shifted to the employees. After protracted negotiations, the family and the union worked out a compromise that today remains the formula for labor relations in the Japanese auto industry. A quarter of the workforce was terminated as originally proposed. But Kiichiro Toyota resigned as president to take responsibility for the company's failure, and the remaining employees received two guarantees. One was for lifetime employment. The other was for pay steeply graded by seniority rather than by specific job function, and tied to company profitability through bonus payments. In short, they became members of the Toyota community, with a full set of rights, including the guarantee of lifetime employment and access to Toyota facilities, housing, recreation, and so forth, that went far beyond what most unions had been able to negotiate for mass production employees in the West. In return, the company expected that most employees would remain with Toyota for their working lives. This was a reasonable expectation, because other Japanese companies adopted seniority-based wages at the same time, and workers would suffer a large loss of earnings if they started out at the bottom of the seniority ladder with another company. The wage progression was quite steep. A 40-year-old worker doing a given job received much higher pay than a 25-year-old doing the same job. If the 40-year-old quit and went to work for another employer, he would start with a zero seniority wage that was below that of even the 25-year-old. The employees also agreed to be flexible in work assignments and active in promoting the interests of the company by initiating improvements rather than merely responding to problems. In effect, the company official said, "If we are going to take you on for life, you have to do your part by doing the jobs that need doing," a bargain to which the unions agreed. Back at the factory, Taichi Ono realized the implications of this historic settlement. The workforce was now as much a short-term fixed cost as the company's machinery, and in the long term, the workers were an even more significant fixed cost. After all, old machinery could be depreciated and scrapped, but Toyota needed to get the most out of its human resources over a 40-year period, that is, from the time new workers entered the company, which in Japan is generally between the ages of 18 and 22, until they reached retirement at age 60. So it made sense to continuously enhance the workers' skills and to gain the benefit of their knowledge and experience, as well as their brawn. Lean production, final assembly plant. Ono's rethinking of final assembly shows just how this new approach to human resources paid enormous dividends for Toyota. Remember that Ford system assumed that assembly line workers would perform one or two simple tasks repetitively and, Ford hoped, without complaint. The foreman did not perform assembly tasks himself, but instead ensured that the line workers followed orders. These orders or instructions were devised by the industrial engineer, who is also responsible for coming up with ways to improve the process. Special repairmen repaired tools. Housekeepers periodically cleaned the work area. Special inspectors checked quality, and defective work, once discovered, was rectified in a rework area after the end of the line. A final category of worker, the utility man, completed the division of labor. Since even high wages were unable to prevent double-digit absenteeism in most mass-production assembly plants, companies needed a large group of utility workers on hand to fill in for those employees who didn't show up each morning. Managers at headquarters generally graded factory management on two criteria, yield and quality. Yield was the number of cars actually produced in relation to the scheduled number, and quality was out-the-door quality after vehicles had defective parts repaired. Factory managers knew that falling below the assigned production target spelled big trouble, and that mistakes could, if necessary, be fixed in the rework area, after the end of the line, but before the cars reached the quality checker from headquarters stationed at the shipping dock. Therefore, it was crucial not to stop the line unless absolutely necessary. Letting cars go on down the line with a misaligned part was perfectly okay, because this type of defect could be rectified in the rework area. But minutes and cars lost to a line stoppage could only be made up with expensive overtime at the end of the shift. Thus was born the move-the-metal mentality of the mass-production auto industry. Ono, who visited Detroit repeatedly just after the war, thought this whole system was rife with muda, the Japanese term for waste that encompasses wasted effort, materials, and time. He reasoned that none of the specialists beyond the assembly worker was actually adding any value to the car. What's more, Ono thought that assembly workers could probably do most of the functions of the specialists and do them much better because of their direct acquaintance with conditions on the line. Indeed, he had just confirmed this observation in the press shop. Yet the role of the assembly worker had the lowest status in the factory. In some Western plants, management actually told assembly workers that they were needed only because automation could not yet replace them. Back at Toyota City, Ono began to experiment. The first step was to group workers into teams with a team leader rather than a foreman. The teams were given a set of assembly steps, their piece of the line, and told to work together on how best to perform the necessary operations. The team leader would do assembly tasks as well as coordinate the team, and in particular, would fill in for any absent worker, concepts unheard of in mass production plants. Ono next gave the team the job of housekeeping, minor tool repair, and quality checking. Finally, as the last step, after the teams were running smoothly, he set time aside periodically for the team to suggest ways collectively to improve the process. In the West, this collective suggestion process would come to be called quality circles. This continuous incremental improvement process, Kaizen in Japanese, took place in collaboration with the industrial engineers, who still existed, but in much smaller numbers. When it came to rework, Ono's thinking was truly inspired. He reasoned that the mass production practice of passing on errors to keep the line running caused errors to multiply endlessly. Every worker could reasonably think that errors would be caught at the end of the line and that he was likely to be disciplined for any action that caused the line to stop. The initial error, whether a bad part or a good part improperly installed, was quickly compounded by assembly workers farther down the line. Once a defective part had become embedded in a complex vehicle, an enormous amount of rectification work might be needed to fix it. And because the problem would not be discovered until the very end of the line, a large number of similarly defective vehicles would have been built before the problem was found. So in striking contrast to the mass production plant, where stopping the line was the responsibility of the senior line manager, Ono placed a cord above every workstation and instructed workers to stop the whole assembly line immediately if a problem emerged that they couldn't fix. Then the whole team would come over to work on the problem. Ono then went much further. In mass production plants, problems tended to be treated as random events. The idea was simply to repair each error and hope that it didn't recur. Ono instead instituted a system of problem solving called the Five Whys. Production workers were taught to trace systematically every error back to its ultimate cause, by asking why as each layer of the problem was uncovered, then to devise a fix so that it would never occur again. Not surprisingly, as Ono began to experiment with these ideas, his production line stopped all the time, and the workers easily became discouraged. However, as the work teams gained experience identifying and tracing problems to their ultimate cause, the number of errors began to drop dramatically. Today, in Toyota plants, where every worker can stop the line, yields approach 100%. That is, the line practically never stops. In mass production plants, by contrast, where no one but the line manager can stop the line still stops constantly. This is not to rectify mistakes, these are fixed at the end, but to deal with material supply and coordination problems. The consequence is that 90% yield is often taken as a sign of good management. Even more striking was what happened at the end of the line. As Ono's system hit its stride, the amount of rework needed before shipment fell continually. Not only that, the quality of the shipped cars steadily improved. This was for the simple reason that quality inspection, no matter how diligent, simply cannot detect all the defects that can be assembled into today's complex vehicles. Today, Toyota assembly plants have practically no rework areas and perform almost no rework. By contrast, as we will show, a number of current-day mass production plants devote 20% of plant area and 25% of their total hours of effort to fixing mistakes. Perhaps the greatest testament to Ono's ideas lies in the quality of the cars actually delivered to the consumer. American buyers report that Toyota's vehicles have among the lowest number of defects of any in the world, comparable to the very best of the German luxury car producers, who devote many hours of assembly plant effort to rectification. Lean production, the supply chain. Assembling the major components into a complete vehicle, the task of the final assembly plant, accounts for only 15% or so of the total manufacturing process. The bulk of the process involves engineering and fabricating more than 10,000 discrete parts and assembling these into perhaps 100 major components, engines, transmissions, steering gears, suspensions, and so forth. Coordinating this process so that everything comes together at the right time with high quality and low cost has been a continuing challenge to the final assembler firms in the auto industry. Under mass production, as we noted earlier, the initial intention was to integrate the entire production system into one huge bureaucratic command structure, with orders coming down from the top. However, even Alfred Sloan's managerial innovations were unequal to this task. The world's mass production assemblers ended up adopting widely varying degrees of formal integration, ranging from about 25% in-house production at small specialist firms such as Porsche and Saab to about 70% at General Motors. Ford, the early leader in vertical integration, which actually did approach 100% at the Rouge, deintegrated after World War II to about 50%. However, the make-or-buy decisions that occasioned so much debate in mass production firms struck Ono and others at Toyota as largely irrelevant, as they began to consider obtaining components for cars and trucks. The real question was how the assembler and the suppliers could work smoothly together to reduce costs and improve quality, whatever formal, legal relationship they might have. And here the mass production approach, whether to make or buy, seemed broadly unsatisfactory. At Ford and GM, the central engineering staffs designed most of the 10,000-plus parts in a vehicle and the component systems they comprised. The firms then gave the drawings to their suppliers, whether formally part of the assembler firm or independent businesses, and asked them for bids on a given number of parts of given quality, usually expressed as a maximum number of defective parts per 1,000. Delivered at a given time. Among all the outside firms and internal divisions that were asked to bid, the low bidder got the business. For certain categories of parts, typically those shared by many vehicles, tires, batteries, alternators, or involving some specialized technology that the assembler firm didn't have, engine computers, for example, independent supplier firms competed to supply the parts, usually by modifying existing standard designs to meet the specifications of a particular vehicle. Again, success depended upon price, quality, and delivery reliability, and the car makers often switched business between firms on relatively short notice. In both cases, corporate managers and small business owners alike understood that it was every firm for itself when sales declined in the cyclical auto industry. Everyone thought of their business relationships as characteristically short-term. As the growing Toyota firm considered this approach to component supply, Ono and others saw many problems. Supplier organizations, working to blueprint, had little opportunity or incentive to suggest improvements in the production design based on their own manufacturing experience. Like employees in the mass production assembly plant, they were told, in effect, to keep their heads down and continue working. Alternatively, suppliers offering standardized designs of their own, modified to specific vehicles, had no practical way of optimizing these parts because they were given practically no information about the rest of the vehicle. Assemblers treated this information as proprietary. And there were other difficulties. Organizing suppliers in vertical chains and playing them against each other in search of the lowest short-term cost blocked the flow of information horizontally between suppliers, particularly on advances in manufacturing techniques. The assembler might ensure that suppliers had low profit margins, but not that they steadily decreased the cost of production through improved organization and process innovations. The same was true of quality. Because the assembler really knew very little about its supplier's manufacturing techniques, whether the supplier in question was inside the assembler firm or independent, it was hard to improve quality except by establishing a maximum acceptable level of defects. As long as most firms in the industry produced to about the same level of quality, it was difficult to raise that level. Finally, there was the problem of coordinating the flow of parts within the supply system on a day-to-day basis. The inflexibility of tools in supplier plants, analogous to the inflexibility of the stamping presses in the assembler plants, and the erratic nature of orders from assemblers responding to shifting market demand, caused suppliers to build large volumes of one type of part before changing over machinery to the next, and to maintain large stocks of finished parts in a warehouse so that the assembler would never have cause to complain, or worse, to cancel a contract because of a delay in delivery. The result was high inventory costs and the routine production of thousands of parts that were later found to be defective when installed at the assembly plant. To counteract these problems, and to respond to a surge in demand in the 1950s, Toyota began to establish a new, lean production approach to components supply. The first step was to organize suppliers into functional tiers, whatever the legal, formal relation of the supplier to the assembler. Different responsibilities were assigned to firms in each tier. First-tier suppliers were responsible for working as an integral part of the product development team in developing a new product. Toyota told them to develop, for example, a steering, braking, or electrical system that would work in harmony with the other systems. First, they were given a performance specification. For example, they were told to design a set of brakes that could stop a 2,200-pound car from 60 miles per hour in 200 feet 10 times in succession without fading. The brakes should fit into a space 6 by 8 by 10 at the end of each axle and be delivered to the assembly plant for $40 a set. The suppliers were then told to deliver a prototype for testing. If the prototype worked, they got a production order. Toyota did not specify what the brakes were made of or how they were to work. These were engineering decisions for the supplier to make. Toyota encouraged its first-tier suppliers to talk among themselves about ways to improve the design process. Because each supplier, for the most part, specialized in one type of component and did not compete in that respect with other suppliers in the group, sharing this information was comfortable and mutually beneficial. Then, each first-tier supplier formed a second tier of suppliers under itself. Companies in the second tier were assigned the job of fabricating individual parts. These suppliers were manufacturing specialists, usually without much expertise in product engineering, but with strong backgrounds in process engineering and plant operations. For example, a first-tier supplier might be responsible for manufacturing alternators. Each alternator has around 100 parts, and the first-tier supplier would obtain all of these parts from second-tier suppliers. Because second-tier suppliers were all specialists in manufacturing processes and not competitors in a specific type of component, it was easy to group them into supplier associations so that they too could exchange information on advances in manufacturing techniques. Toyota did not wish to vertically integrate its suppliers into a single large bureaucracy. Neither did it wish to de-integrate them into completely independent companies with only a marketplace relationship. Instead, Toyota spun its in-house supply operations off into quasi-independent first-tier supplier companies in which Toyota retained a fraction of the equity and developed similar relationships with other suppliers who had been completely independent. As the process proceeded, Toyota's first-tier suppliers acquired much of the rest of the equity in each other. Toyota, for instance, today holds 22% of Nippon Denso, which makes electrical components and engine computers, 14% of Toyota Gosei, which makes seats and wiring systems, 12% of Aishin Seiki, which makes metal engine parts, and 19% of Koito, which makes trim items, upholstery, and plastics. These firms in turn have substantial cross-holdings in each other. In addition, Toyota often acts as banker for its supplier group, providing loans to finance the process machinery required for a new product. Finally, Toyota shared personnel with its supplier group firms in two ways. It would lend them personnel to deal with workload surges, and it would transfer senior managers not in line for top positions at Toyota to senior positions in supplier firms. Consequently, the Toyota suppliers were independent companies with completely separate books. They were real profit centers rather than the sham profit centers of many vertically integrated mass production firms. Moreover, Toyota encouraged them to perform considerable work for other assemblers and for firms in other industries, because outside business almost always generated higher profit margins. Nippon Denso, for example, a $7 billion company, is the largest manufacturer in the world of electrical and electronic systems and engine computers. As we mentioned, Toyota holds 22% of its equity, and Nippon Denso does 60% of its business with Toyota. probably another 30% of Nippon Denso's equity is held in the Toyota Supplier Group of companies, and 6% is held by Robert Bosch, the giant German components firm. The rest trades publicly. At the same time, these suppliers are intimately involved in Toyota's product development, have interlocking equity with Toyota and Toyota Group members, rely on Toyota for outside financing, and accept Toyota people into their personnel systems. In a very real sense, they share their destinies with Toyota. Finally, Ono developed a new way to coordinate the flow of parts within the supply system on a day-to-day basis, the famous just-in-time system called Kanban at Toyota. Ono's idea was simply to convert a vast group of suppliers and parts plants into one large machine, like Henry Ford's Highland Park plant, by dictating that parts would only be produced at each previous step to supply the immediate demand of the next step. The mechanism was the containers carrying parts to the next step. As each container was used up, it was sent back to the previous step, and this became the automatic signal to make more parts. This simple idea was enormously difficult to implement in practice because it eliminated practically all inventories and meant that when one small part of the vast production system failed, the whole system came to a stop. In Ono's view, this was precisely the power of his idea. It removed all safety nets and focused every member of the vast production process on anticipating problems before they became serious enough to stop everything. It took Eiji Toyota and Ono more than 20 years of relentless effort to fully implement this full set of ideas, including just-in-time, within the Toyota supply chain. In the end, they succeeded, with extraordinary consequences for productivity, product quality, and responsiveness to changing market demand. As we'll see in chapters 4 and 5, the lean supply chain became a major strength of the lean production system. Lean production, product development, and engineering. Wherever it occurs, at central engineering headquarters or in the supplier organizations, the process of engineering a manufactured object as complex as today's motor vehicle demands enormous effort from large numbers of people with a broad range of skills. Therefore, it's easy to make mistakes in organizing the process so that the whole of the results achieved is mysteriously less than the sum of the parts. Mass production companies try to solve the complexity problem by finely dividing labor among many engineers with very specific specialties. Professor Kim Clark of the Harvard Business School reports, for instance, finding an engineer in a mass production auto company who had spent his whole career designing auto door locks. He was not an expert on how to make door locks, however. That was the job of the door lock manufacturing engineer. The door lock design engineer simply knew how they should look and work if made correctly. The weaknesses of this system of divided labor were easy to see, and mass production companies over the years tried to devise coordination mechanisms. Even in the mid-1980s, though, the best solution they had found was the product development team with a weak leader, really just a coordinator, whose members still reported to the senior executive of their individual technical specialties. Significantly, career paths in most Western firms still followed a constricted progression through their technical department, junior piston engineer to senior piston engineer, and then junior drivetrain engineer to senior drivetrain engineer, and so forth. One might someday hope to reach the position of chief product engineer, the level at which disagreements among product engineers, manufacturing process engineers, and industrial engineers in the plants were worked out. Ono and Toyota, by contrast, decided early on that product engineering inherently encompassed both process and industrial engineering. Thus, they formed teams with strong leaders that contained all the relevant expertise. Career paths were structured so that rewards went to strong team players, rather than to those displaying genius in a single area of product, process, or industrial engineering, but without regard to their function as a team. As we'll see in Chapter 5, the consequence of this approach to lean engineering was a dramatic leap in productivity, product quality, and responsiveness to changing consumer demand. Lean production and changing consumer demand. The new Toyota production system was especially well-suited to capitalize upon the changing demands that consumers were placing on their cars and upon changing vehicle technology. By the 1960s, cars and light trucks were increasingly a part of daily life in developed countries. Almost everyone, even people with no inherent interest in cars, depended on them to get through the day. Simultaneously, vehicles were acquiring features that made them quite impossible for the average user to repair. The putty knife and wrench that could fix almost anything that could go wrong with a Model T were of little use by the 1980s for a broken engine management computer or anti-skid braking system. Also, as households began to acquire more than one vehicle, people no longer wanted just the standard size car or truck. The market began to fragment into many product segments. For the Toyota production system, these developments were all blessings. Consumers began to report that the most important feature of their car or truck was reliability. It had to start every morning and could never leave the user stranded. Vehicle malfunctions were no longer a challenge for the home tinkerer, but were inexplicable nightmares, even for owners with considerable mechanical skills. Because the Toyota system could deliver superior reliability, soon Toyota found that it no longer had to match exactly the price of competing mass-production products. Furthermore, Toyota's flexible production system and its ability to reduce production engineering costs let the company supply the product variety that buyers wanted with little cost penalty. In 1990, Toyota is offering consumers around the world as many products as General Motors, even though Toyota is still half GM size. To change production and model specifications in mass production firms takes many years and costs a fortune. By contrast, a preeminent lean producer, such as Toyota, needs half the time and effort required by a mass producer, such as GM, to design a new car. So Toyota can offer twice as many vehicles with the same development budget. Ironically, most Western companies concluded that the Japanese succeeded because they produced standardized products in ultra-high volume. As recently as 1987, a manufacturing manager in Detroit confided in an interview with members of our project that he had found the secret of Japanese success. They are making identical tin cans. If I did that, I could have high quality and low cost too. This illusion stems from the fact that the Japanese companies initially minimized distribution costs by focusing on one or two product categories in each export market. However, the total product portfolio of the Japanese firms has always been broader, and they have steadily increased their product range in every world market. Today they offer almost as many models as all of the Western firms combined, as we will see in Chapter 5. In addition, their product variety continues to grow rapidly, even as Western firms stand still on average and actually reduce the number of different models made in each of their factories. Ford and GM, for example, have been focusing their assembly plants toward the goal of one basic product in each plant. By contrast, the Japanese transplants in North America all build two or three products. Because product lives now average just 4 years, the average production volume of a Japanese car over the period of its production is now one quarter that of the Western mass market producers, and the gap is widening. That is, the Japanese currently make, on average, 125,000 copies of each of their car models each year. The seven Western high-volume companies make nearly twice as many. However, the Japanese keep models in production 4 years on average, while the Western companies keep them in production almost 10 years. This means that during the life of a model, the Japanese make 500,000 copies, 125,000 times 4, while the Western companies make 2 million, 200,000 times 10, a 4-to-1 difference. Even more striking, Japanese producers such as Toyota are already producing at only 2/3 of the life of the model production volume of European specialist firms such as Mercedes and BMW. Indeed, with the arrival of a host of new Japanese niche cars, such as the Honda NSX, the Japanese may be able to do what mass production firms never could: attack the surviving craft-based niche producers, such as Aston Martin and Ferrari, to bring the whole world into the age of lean production. Lean production, dealing with the customer. All of the variety available from lean production would be for naught if the lean producer could not build what the customer wanted. Thus, from an early date, Eiji Toyoda and his marketing expert Shotaro Kamiya began to think about the link between the production system and the consumer. For Henry Ford, this link had been very simple, because there was no product variety and because most repairs could be handled by the owner. The job of the dealer was simply to have enough cars and spare parts in stock to supply expected demand. In addition, because demand of the American car market fluctuated wildly from the earliest days of the industry, the assembler tended to use the dealer as a shock absorber to cushion the factory from the need to increase and reduce production continually. The result, fully in place by the 1920s, was a system of small, financially independent dealers who maintained a vast inventory of cars and trucks waiting for buyers. Relations between the factory and the dealer were distant and usually strained, as the factory tried to force cars on dealers to smooth production. Relations between the dealer and the customer were equally strained because dealers continually adjusted prices, made deals, to adjust demand with supply while maximizing profits. As anyone who has bought a car in North America or Europe knows, this has been a system marked by a lack of long-term commitment on either side, which maximizes feelings of mistrust. In order to maximize bargaining position, everyone holds back information: the dealer about the product, the consumer about his or her true desires, and everyone loses in the long term. Kamiya had learned this system by working in General Motors' Japanese distribution system in the 1930s, but it seemed broadly unsatisfactory. Therefore, after the war, he and Toyota began to think of new ways to distribute cars. Their solution, worked out gradually over time, was to build a sales network very similar to the Toyota supplier group, a system that had a very different relation with the customer. Specifically, the Toyota Motor Sales Company built up a network of distributors, some wholly owned and some in which Toyota held a small equity stake, who had a shared destiny with Toyota. These dealers developed a new set of techniques that Toyota came to call aggressive selling. The basic idea was to develop a long-term, indeed a lifelong, relation between the assembler, the dealer, and the buyer, by building the dealer into the production system and the buyer into the product development process. The dealer became part of the production system as Toyota gradually stopped building cars in advance for unknown buyers and converted to a build-to-order system, in which the dealer was the first step in the Kanban system, sending orders for pre-sold cars to the factory for delivery to specific customers in 2 to 3 weeks. To make this workable, however, the dealer had to work closely with the factory to sequence orders in a way the factory could accommodate. While Ono's production system was remarkably adept at building products to specific order, it could not deal with large surges or troughs in total demand, or abrupt shifts in demand between products that could not be built with the same tools. For example, between the largest and smallest cars in the product range, or between cars and trucks. Sequencing orders was possible in turn because Toyota's sales staff did not wait in the showroom for orders. Instead, they went directly to customers by making house calls. When demand began to droop, they worked more hours, and when demand shifted, they concentrated on households they knew were likely to want the type of car the factory could build. The latter was possible because of a second feature of aggressive selling: a massive database on households and their buying preferences that Toyota gradually built up on every household ever showing interest in a Toyota product. With this information in hand, Toyota's sales staff could target their efforts to the most likely buyers. The system also could incorporate the buyer into the product development process and in a very direct way. Toyota focused relentlessly on repeat buyers, critical in a country where government vehicle inspections, the famous Shoken, resulted in practically every car being scrapped after 6 years. Toyota was determined never to lose a former buyer, and could minimize the chance of this happening by using the data in its consumer database to predict what Toyota buyers would want next as their incomes, family size, driving patterns, and tastes changed. Unlike mass producers who conduct product evaluation clinics and other survey research on randomly selected buyers, buyers presumed to have little brand loyalty. Toyota went directly to its existing customers in planning new products. Established customers were treated as members of the Toyota family, and brand loyalty became a salient feature of Toyota's lean production system. The future of lean production. Toyota had fully worked out the principles of lean production by the early 1960s. The other Japanese auto firms adopted most of them as well, although this took many years. For example, Mazda did not fully embrace Ono's ideas for running factories and the supplier system until it encountered a crisis in 1973, when export demand for its fuel-hungry Wankel-engine cars collapsed. The first step of the Sumitomo Group in offering help to Mazda was to insist that the company's Hiroshima production complex rapidly remake itself in the image of Toyota City at Nagoya. What's more, not all firms became equally adept at operating the system. One of our most important objectives in this volume is to educate the public to the fact that some Japanese firms are leaner than others, and that several of the old-fashioned mass production firms in the West are rapidly becoming lean as well. Nevertheless, by the 1960s, the Japanese firms on average had gained an enormous advantage over mass producers elsewhere, and were able for a period of 20 years to boost their share of world motor vehicle production steadily by exporting from their highly focused production complexes in Japan. This path of export-led development came to an abrupt halt after 1979. As the world economy slumped, trade imbalances with North America and Europe reached unmanageable proportions, and trade barriers were erected. In the 1980s, the world was at the same point in the diffusion of lean production that it was with mass production in the 1920s. The leading practitioners of the new method are now of necessity attempting to increase their share of the world market through direct investment in North America and Europe, rather than through ever-growing exports of finished units. Meanwhile, American, European, and even Korean firms, often accomplished masters of now obsolete mass production, are trying to match or exceed the performance of their lean challengers. This process is enormously exciting. It also produces enormous tensions. There will be real losers, including some of the smaller and less accomplished Japanese firms, as well as winners. And the public everywhere tends all too readily to interpret the contest in simple, nationalistic terms. Us versus them. Our country versus theirs. We will return to the problem of diffusing lean production in the final chapters of this audiobook, because we believe it is one of the most important issues facing the world economy in the 1990s. However, we first need to gain a deeper understanding of the elements of lean production. The elements of lean production. The general public has a simple and vivid mental image of auto production. The assembly plant where all the parts come together to create the finished car or truck. While this final manufacturing step is important, it represents only about 15% of the human effort involved in making a car. To properly understand lean production, we must look at every step in the process, beginning with product design and engineering, then going far beyond the factory to the customer, who relies on the automobile for daily living. In addition, it is critical to understand the mechanism of coordination necessary to bring all these steps into harmony and on a global scale. a mechanism we call the Lean Enterprise. In the chapters just ahead, we proceed through each of the steps of lean production. We begin with the part of the system everyone thinks they understand, the factory, as represented by the assembly plant, to show systematically how very different lean production is from the ideas of Henry Ford. We proceed to product development and engineering, then into the supply system, where the bulk of manufacturing occurs. Next, we look at the system of selling cars and trucks, the end of the production process in the world of mass production, but the beginning of the process in lean production. Finally, we examine the type of global lean enterprise needed to make the whole system work, the one aspect of lean production that is still not fully developed. Chapter 4. Running the Factory. The automotive assembly plant dominates its landscape, wherever in the world it's located. From a distance, it is a vast windowless mass surrounded by acres of storage areas and railway yards. The complex shape of the building and the lack of a facade often make it hard to know just where to enter. Once inside, the scene is initially bewildering. Thousands of workers in one vast building tend to streams of vehicles moving across the floor, while a complex network of conveyors and belts in the lofty ceiling carries parts to and fro. The scene is dense, hectic, noisy. On first exposure, it's like finding oneself inside a Swiss watch, fascinating but incomprehensible, and a little frightening as well. In 1986, at the outset of the IMVP, we set out to contrast lean production with mass production by carefully surveying as many of the world's motor vehicle assembly plants as possible. In the end, we visited and systematically gathered information on more than 90 plants in 17 countries, or about half of the assembly capacity of the entire world. Ours would prove one of the most comprehensive international surveys ever undertaken in the automobile or any other industry. This chapter is based on the IMVP World Assembly Plant Survey. The survey was initiated by John Krafcik, who was later joined by John Paul McDuffie. Haruo Shimada also assisted. Why did we choose the assembly plant for study? Why not the engine plant, say, or the brake plant, or the alternator factory? And why so many plants in so many countries? Surely the best lean production plant in Japan and the worst mass production plant in North America or Europe would have sufficiently demonstrated the differences between lean and mass production. Three factors convinced us that the assembly plant was the most useful activity in the motor vehicle production system to study. First, a large part of the work in the auto industry involves assembly. This is so simply because of the large number of parts in a car. Much of this assembly occurs in components plants. For example, an alternator plant will gather from suppliers or fabricate the 100 or so discrete parts in an alternator, then assemble them into a complete unit. However, it's hard to understand assembly in such a plant because the final activity usually makes up only a small part of the total. In the final assembly plant, by contrast, the sole activity is assembly, welding and screwing several thousand simple parts and complex components into a finished vehicle. Second, assembly plants all over the world do almost exactly the same things, because practically all of today's cars and light trucks are built with very similar fabrication techniques. In almost every assembly plant, about 300 stamped steel panels are spot welded into a complete body. Then the body is dipped and sprayed to protect it from corrosion. Next, it is painted. Finally, thousands of mechanical parts, electrical items, and bits of upholstery are installed inside the painted body to produce the complete automobile. Because these tasks are so uniform, we can meaningfully compare a plant in Japan with one in Canada, another in West Germany, and still another in China, even though they are making cars that look very different as they emerge from the factory. Finally, we chose the assembly plant for study because Japanese efforts to spread lean production by building plants in North America and Europe initially involved assembly plants. When we began our survey in 1986, three Japanese-managed assembly plants were already in operation in the United States, and one was ready to open in England. By contrast, Japanese plants for engines, brakes, alternators, and other components, though publicly announced for North America and Europe, were still in the planning stage. We knew from experience that it's pointless to examine a company's blueprints for a new plant or to look at a plant just as it starts production. To see the full difference between lean and mass production at the plant level, we had to compare plants operating at full volume. What about the second question we are often asked? Why study so many plants in so many countries? The answer is simple. Lean production is now spreading from Japan to practically every nation. Directly in its path are the giant mass production plants of the previous industrial era. In every country and every company, including, we might add, in the less accomplished companies in Japan, we have found an intense, even desperate desire to know the answer to two simple questions. Where do we stand, and what must we do to match the new competitive level required by lean production? Now we know the answers. Classic Mass Production, GM, Framingham. We began our survey in 1986 at General Motors' Framingham, Massachusetts assembly plant, just a few miles south of our home base in Boston. We chose Framingham not because it was nearby, but because we strongly suspected it embodied all the elements of classic mass production. Our first interview with the plant's senior managers was not promising. They had just returned from a tour of the Toyota GM joint venture plant, NUMMI, where John Krafchik, our assembly plant survey leader, formerly worked. One reported that secret repair areas and secret inventories had to exist behind the NUMMI plant, because he hadn't seen enough of either for a real plant. Another manager wondered what all the fuss was about. They build cars just like we do. A third warned that all that NUMMI talk about lean production is not welcome around here. Despite this cold beginning, we found the plant management enormously helpful. All over the world, as we have since discovered again and again, managers and workers badly want to learn where they stand and how to improve. Their fear of just how bad things might be is, in fact, what often creates initial hostility. On the plant floor, we found about what we had expected, a classic mass production environment with its many dysfunctions. We began by looking down the aisles next to the assembly line. They were crammed with what we term indirect workers. Workers on their way to relieve a fellow employee. Machine repairers en route to troubleshoot a problem. Housekeepers. Inventory runners. None of these workers actually add value, and companies can find other ways to get their jobs done. Next, we looked at the line itself. Next to each workstation were piles, in some cases weeks' worth, of inventory. Littered about were discarded boxes and other temporary wrapping material. On the line itself, the work was unevenly distributed, with some workers running madly to keep up, and others finding time to smoke or even read a newspaper. In addition, at a number of points, the workers seemed to be struggling to attach poorly fitting parts to the Oldsmobile Sierra models they were building. The parts that wouldn't fit at all were unceremoniously chucked in trash cans. At the end of the line, we found what is perhaps the best evidence of old-fashioned mass production, an enormous work area full of finished cars riddled with defects. All these cars needed further repair before shipment, a task that can prove enormously time-consuming and often fails to fix fully the problems now buried under layers of parts and upholstery. On our way back through the plant to discuss our findings with the senior managers, we found two final signs of mass production. Large buffers of finished bodies awaiting their trip through the paint booth, and from the paint booth to the final assembly line, and massive stores of parts, many still in the railway cars in which they had been shipped from General Motors components plants in the Detroit area. Finally, a word on the workforce. Dispirited is the only label that would fit. Framingham workers had been laid off a half dozen times since the beginning of the American industry's crisis in 1979, and they seemed to have little hope that the plant could long hold out against the lean production facilities locating in the American Midwest. Classic Lean Production, Toyota Takaoka. Our next step was the Toyota assembly plant at Takaoka in Toyota City. Like Framingham, built in 1948, this is a middle-aged facility from 1966. It had a much larger number of welding and painting robots in 1986, but was hardly a high-tech facility of the sort General Motors was then building for its new GM10 models, in which computer-guided carriers replaced the final assembly line. The differences between Takaoka and Framingham are striking to anyone who understands the logic of lean production. For a start, hardly anyone was in the aisles. The armies of indirect workers so visible at GM were missing, and practically every worker in sight was actually adding value to the car. This fact was even more apparent because Takaoka's aisles are so narrow. Toyota's philosophy about the amount of plant space needed for a given production volume is just the opposite of GM's at Framingham. Toyota believes in having as little space as possible, so that face-to-face communication among workers is easier, and there is no room to store inventories. GM, by contrast, has believed that extra space is necessary to work on vehicles needing repairs, and to store the large inventories needed to ensure smooth production. The final assembly line revealed further differences. Less than an hour's worth of inventory was set next to each worker at Takaoka. The parts went on more smoothly, and the work tasks were better balanced, so that every worker worked at about the same pace. When a worker found a defective part, there are no women working in Toyota plants in Japan, carefully tagged it and sent it to the quality control area in order to obtain a replacement part. Once in quality control, employees subjected the part to what Toyota calls the five whys, in which, as we explained in Chapter 2, the reason for the defect is traced back to its ultimate cause so that it will not recur. As we noted, each worker along the line can pull a cord just above the workstation to stop the line if any problem is found. At GM, only senior managers can stop the line for any reason other than safety, but it stops frequently due to problems with machinery or materials delivery. At Takaoka, every worker can stop the line, but the line is almost never stopped because problems are solved in advance, and the same problem never occurs twice. Clearly, paying relentless attention to preventing defects has removed most of the reasons for the line to stop. At the end of the line, the difference between lean and mass production was even more striking. At Takaoka, we observed almost no rework area at all. Almost every car was driven directly from the line to the boat or the trucks, taking cars to the buyer. On the way back through the plant, we observed yet other differences between this plant and Framingham. There were practically no buffers between the welding shop and paint booth, and between paint and final assembly. And there were no parts warehouses at all. Instead, parts were delivered directly to the line at hourly intervals from the supplier plants where they had just been made. Indeed, our initial plant survey form asked how many days of inventory were in the plant. A Toyota manager politely asked whether there was an error in translation. Surely we meant minutes of inventory. A final and striking difference with Framingham was the morale of the workforce. The work pace was clearly harder at Takaoka, and yet there was a sense of purposefulness, not simply of workers going through the motions with their minds elsewhere under the watchful eye of the foreman. No doubt this was in considerable part